topics, and delightful to introduce first Peter Winkler to talk on random homomorphisms.
Thank you, Pavel. We've heard a lot of good stuff about graph homomorphisms and colorings and independent sets in this workshop so far, mostly of of the nature of extremal problems. And what I'd like to do this morning is go into another realm, that of random homomorphisms, including random colorings and random independent sets. This, of course, is a great tradition from Erdős, who began the study of random graphs. The study of random homomorphisms has a more confusing history, and as you will see, comes from statistical physics as well as from combinatorics. So we'll be mixing a little of those things today. I will lead into a little bit the topic of dismantleable graphs, which Graham will continue with this afternoon. Graham's talk will be less random, so we'll be really taking you back more into the realm of sort of straight combinatorics this afternoon. I thought that I would start with really the most difficult and confusing question of all, which is the subject of my affiliation.
I wonder, does Lucy's stock go up when you do something good like this?
I think these things are completely independent. Anyhow, this is me down here, Bell Laboratories, Lucent Technologies, in Murray Hill, New Jersey. Now, having got that out of the way,
can you put it on the other role?
I'd like to conduct a little experiment with you. What I want to do is I want to play. I've got a checkerboard here, well, a somewhat generalized checkerboard. It might be easier to see if I turn. How's that? That's better.
The other one.
Both of them?
Yeah.
Oh, even better. Okay. A generalized checkerboard here. What I'd like to do is I'd like to put checkers down on this board, but subject to the constraint that no two checkers are next to each other, either east-west or north-south. Okay. So effectively what I'm doing is I'm choosing an independent set in the grid graph. And here is one such independent set. Okay. Now, it's important to emphasize that I didn't choose this independent set by just putting checkers down one at a time until I was tired of putting checkers down. Instead, this independent set is chosen uniformly at random from every possible independent set on the grid. So there's a zillion or so independent sets on this grid, and somehow, subject of another talk, I have selected one uniformly at random. It could have been the empty one. Although, if it were, I'd probably have to do it again. Because it's not a very illustrative example. This is the one it did happen to be. Okay, I'm actually quite interested in the question of which checkers fall on the red squares, the even squares, and which ones fall on the blue squares. So I'm going to give you another picture of this configuration, where all I've done is I've colored only the squares on which checkers fell. Okay. So here is that picture. Now, you may notice that this doesn't exactly look like, a salt and pepper combination of blue squares and red squares. The colors tend to be a little bit bunched. And the reason for that is, of course, that you can't have a red square and a blue square very close to each other. Blue squares can at least be diagonally close, but the red ones have to be a little separate. So a little bunching is sort of induced by this constraint. And this actually is one corner of a larger experiment, which I'll show you here. Okay. Again, I'm not sure the camera or the back row can see this, but this is a random independent set in a larger grid with the points falling on blue squares marked with blue squares, points on red squares with red squares. Now, okay, again, I think it looks a little bit bunchy compared to what you would expect for a complete salt and pepper. But suppose I want to make it more bunchy. Well, if I crowd more points into this independent set, then you can imagine that they're really going to be forced to be a little more coherently arranged. So how do I crowd more points into this independent set in a nice manner? And what I'm going to propose to do is this. Instead of choosing the independent set uniformly at random, I'm going to weight the independent sets in order to favor the big ones. Okay. And the way I do this is I choose a number lambda greater than 1. Okay. And I weight an independent set proportional to lambda to the power of the number of points in the independent set. Okay. So, for example, if lambda equals 2, then I'm giving an independent set double the weight for every extra point that it has over some other independent set. I could also do that by making it a multicolored independent set or something like this. So it can be done combinatorially. But this is a very natural generalization of the uniform distribution, which you'll see a lot of this morning. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take lambda and I'm going to push it up all the way to 3.7 and get another random independent set. And now it looks like this. Now we're getting substantial apartheid here. Red points are bunching. There's still, you know, little red islands in among the blue points and vice versa, and islands and lakes. Okay, that's up for lambda up to about 3.7 something. If I push it just a tiny bit harder to 3.8, now the picture looks like this. What has happened is we've pushed lambda so hard that there has been a spontaneous symmetry breaking and the blue points have taken over. Right. Now, half the time, if I do this, of course, the red points will take over. But the point about it now is that when lambda is up above this threshold, all of a sudden these random independent sets have a completely different character. Instead of being balanced between red and blue, they will be lopsided one way or the other almost every time. And the physicists say that we have undergone a phase transition and a phenomenon which you also see in random graphs and other parts of probabilistic combinatorics, but which is the phenomenon that statistical physicists like to study. Okay. So what's happened here is we've made a small change in a microscopic parameter, this little lambda thing, and now we witness a global change in what these random objects look like. Now there are a lot of different ways of expressing the nature of this global change. One way, as you saw, is that you change from balanced things to imbalanced things. Sometimes you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. It's also the case that if you're interested in Markov chains and fast mixing, that you've moved from an area where you can get random things easily by moving from one to the other to another realm where you can't, because if you change this thing one point at a time, it'll take you forever to get to a red configuration. It'll tend to stay all blue. And there's one other really beautiful characterization discovered by Debruchen, Lanford, and Ruel, three statistical physicists, to explain the difference between this realm here and the disordered realm that we saw before. And that is by looking at an infinite graph and asking about probability distributions on this infinite graph, which work like these distributions here. Okay, so let me give you another example. Now, the physicists really like graphs like grid graphs in two or more dimensions. But they have noticed that often they can prove things for Cayley graphs. And Graham and I have taken merciless advantage of that. And most of what we do today will be on Cayley graphs. So this is not a Cayley graph, but a finite piece of the infinite binary tree. Okay, and what I've done here is, again, I've chosen an independent set marked by these dark painted vertices in this binary tree. And again, it's been chosen simply by taking an independent set uniformly at random from all possible independent sets. Now, what I'd like to do is think about random independent sets on the whole infinite binary tree. But you can't just willy-nilly walk in and define what it means for something to be random when it's chosen from an infinite set. Okay? So we'd like to have a nice notion of what it means to have a random independent set in the complete binary tree. And then maybe we could answer questions like, oh, what's the probability that a given point is in that infinite set? In other words, what's the density of this random independent set? Okay. So in order to do that, well, a logical thing to do is take finite pieces and look at random independent sets in those, and then take the limit as the binary tree gets bigger. So that's what I've tried to do here. But I'm running across a bit of a funny phenomenon here. Because I've cut the tree off at level 8, I think is what it is here, I've got a lot of these leaves here with degree only 1. And it's very easy for a leaf to be in the independent set, right? Because it only kills off one neighbor from being in the independent set. So there's actually a lot of points on the outside ring of this thing that are in the independent set. And that tends to denude the next layer in somewhat. But then the next layer in can have more points. So there's a little bit of an oscillating phenomenon as we come down toward the root. And what actually happens is that those oscillations die down. So if you grow this thing larger and you take limits of probability distributions, everything works. And you get a certain limiting probability that any given point is in the independent set. However, let's do the same trick we did before and raise the stakes. Here is a random independent set, again, in this finite piece of the binary tree. And now I've weighted by lambda equals 5. So I've really given these things a big rewards for being big. So now there's really very big incentive for those outside leaves to be in the independent set. And that really strips off the next layer. And you can really see the oscillation in this picture, on, off, on, off. Now we have a problem. Because now when we take this oscillation doesn't die down as the tree gets bigger. It doesn't die down to zero. So if we try to take a limit when the tree gets bigger, we discover that when we have an even tree, the center is most likely unoccupied, and when we have an odd tree, the center is much more likely to be occupied, and we haven't got a limit. And we don't, in effect, have a notion of a random independent set in the infinite binary tree now when lambda equals 5. Here's a little mathematical picture of what's going on. In the left-hand picture, I've plotted the probability that that center point is in the independent set as a function of the depth of the tree. And it oscillates some, but it but it eventually approaches a limit. But on the right-hand side, when we've raised the stakes, it approaches these two limits. And on the next graph, what I've done is I've plotted the limits as we raise lambda. So everything is ordinary until lambda hits 4. And then there's what we call a pitchfork bifurcation. And if we take even depth trees, it goes this way. And we take odd depth trees, it goes that way. So weird behavior. Now, it turns out that this problem is completely solvable mathematically. And suppose we have a k-branching tree instead of a binary tree. So that means a regular tree of degree k plus 1. Apologize for that. And it turns out that the critical lambda is equal to k to the k over k minus 1 to the k plus 1, which works out to 4 for a binary tree. An interesting thing is that if the tree is 5 branching, then this critical value of lambda drops below 1. So what does that mean? Well, when lambda equals 1, we have the ordinary uniform distribution. Okay. So what we're saying is that if we have a regular tree of degree 3, 4, 5, then we have a notion of a uniformly random independent set. But when the degree hits 6, the notion disappears. We don't have a single notion of a uniformly random independent set. That's somehow disappears, gone. All right, now, so to us in combinatorics, this is random independent sets in a tree, okay. It actually is something quite different to a physicist. It's something called the hardcore lattice gas model on a beta lattice. You don't want to know. But the hardcore gas model is one of these physics models, like the Ising or Ising model that you've probably heard of. And it's a model where you imagine that there's gas filling space, but the particles are hardcore particles. They can't get too close to each other. Hence the independent set restriction. And so the physicists have seen this behavior in what is called, for short, the hardcore model. If you're interested in the hardcore model, if you like independent sets, you should be. There's a marvelous article by Jeff Steifen and Rob Vandenberg, which I can give you the reference for, which is actually readable by a combinatorialist. In fact, that article helped me get interested in this stuff years ago. One thing that you should not do if you're interested in the hardcore model is to go to your web search engine with the phrase, with the words hardcore model. Turns out, interestingly, that this model has also been studied in the mathematics of communications, which I'm supposed to be interested in, and as a model for call blocking. Okay, and in fact, Frank Kelly, who is from Cambridge, who sort of a combinatorialist to study this stuff, was one of the people to compute this formula for lambda. All right, so that's background stuff. You sort of get the idea of what we're going for. Now, it turns out that there are other kinds of random things that we might be interested in combinatorics, like random colorings and random homomorphisms. And there are also other kinds of hard constraint models that the physicists have been looking at. So what Graham and I set out to do was to try to figure out which kinds of these situations can result in these marvelous phase transitions and which ones can't. Okay. So that's the object for what I'm going to talk about today. Now, what we'd really like to do is answer that question for grid graphs and stuff like that in space. But our tools were suitable for answering these questions on Cayley trees. And one of the marvelous things that we can do as mathematicians is we can't answer a question, we can change the question, or at least limit the question, which is what we've done here. And it turns out that these Kalichis also give us a chance to use one of our favorite tools, which is random walks on graphs, and you'll see where they come into it. All right, so what is a hard constraint model? What's going on here? Well, we're interested in what we call constraint graphs. And a constraint graph is some small graph which may or may not have loops. We're not interested in multiple edges, but their loops can be important. And a constraint graph tells you what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do when you color this big Cayley tree. Okay. So let me show you what that means. Here are three constraint graphs. The independent set graph, the idea is that this edge between the blue point and the white point tells you that when you color your big tree with blue and white, that you're allowed to have a blue point next to a white one. And because there's an edge, because there's a loop at white, means you're also allowed to have a white one next to a white one. But since there's no loop at blue, you're not allowed to have a blue point next to a blue point. So what am I saying, really? I'm saying that an independent set, identified by coloring the vertices with blue points, is exactly the same thing as a homomorphism from a graph into this graph. So it's a random homomorphism. Okay? Now, we all know, well know here in this workshop, that a proper coloring of a graph is a homomorphism from that graph into the complete graph, with K colors, if you're K coloring. And it's important that there are no loops. It means that we can't have a green vertex next to a green vertex when we color our graph. Okay? If we do put the loops in, then we can color any way we want. And it's really easy to get random colorings if there are no constraints, right? You just take each point of the graph one at a time, color it at random. There's your random coloring. Boring. Okay, so nothing's going to happen on the right-hand constraint graph. Here are two other constraint graphs that have arisen in papers written by statistical physicists, and we'll leave those be. There's another very nice statistical physics model, however, called the Widom-Rowlandson model, which you will see a little later on in the talk. Okay. So what happens is we're interested in fixing one of these constraint graphs, one at a time, and looking at random homomorphisms from our Cayley tree to whichever constraint graph H that we fix. Okay. And one thing we can do is we can look for ones which are chosen uniformly at random, but we want to generalize in the same way we did before. So what I want to do is I want to associate with each point of the constraint graph a positive real number which we call the activity of the vertex. And the activity of a vertex is a number which tells you how hard you're working to use that color. Okay? So before, when we were coloring with independent sets, we were putting activity 1 on the white vertex and activity lambda on the blue vertex. Okay? Now that means if we're coloring a finite graph, then the probability of a given coloring is obtained, before normalizing, it's obtained by just multiplying together all the lambdas of all the colors that you've used on the graph. And that's what this formula tells you. Now, a better way maybe to think of it, though, is this. Suppose that you're busy coloring your Cayley tree with, according to one of these constraint graphs, and you come to a point which is not colored yet, but you know the color of its colors of its neighbors. Okay. Then there may be several colors which are eligible by looking at your constraint graph, you can tell. Maybe blue and red are both possible. Well, then, the activities of blue and red will tell you the relative probabilities with which you use blue and red. If blue has activity 3 and red has activity 2, then you should be using blue 3/5 of the time and red 2/5 of the time. So the activities tell you the conditional probabilities. And the physicists call them the specifications for the model. If the activities are all 1, then we're looking at the ordinary uniform distribution. Okay. Now, so just the bottom of that slide. Now, this formula here works fine if the graph you're coloring, if the graph you're coloring or making a homomorphism out of, G, is finite. Otherwise, it doesn't work at all. It just gives you an infinite number. So what we'd like to do is figure out when is it the case that there's a unique, nice way to define the probability distribution on an infinite Cayley tree. And the idea is that when there's a unique, nice way to do it, then we have nice behavior, the kind that we usually expect. But when there's more than one way to do it, then we have this bizarre phase transition stuff. Okay. So what do we want? If we take the infinite Cayley tree, we want a probability distribution on the legal colorings of it by some constraint graph. What properties should that probability distribution have? We want to make it look just like the uniform probability distribution on a finite graph. And this slide shows you essentially everything that Graham and I could think of that the finite uniform distribution satisfies. Okay. So in this particular case, just for the purpose of the pictures, I've imagined that the graph I'm coloring is the complete binary tree T2. And the constraint graph is K3. So I'm doing an ordinary proper 3 coloring. Now, you know, binary tree is like, in fact, all trees are 2 colorable, so they're really pretty easy to 3 color. But still, I mean, you know, you can't have the same color on neighboring vertices, so you've got to be a little careful here. And I want to know, okay, what do I want if I want to talk about a uniform 3 coloring of the whole binary tree? And I want it to have the following property. The most important property, sometimes called the Gibbs property, is that if we restrict to a finite piece of the tree, then the coloring should behave just like it does on a finite tree. Okay. But you have to be a little careful how you say that, because suppose we cut this piece out of the tree. And we want to ask, what's the probability for colorings of that, the white stuff there that's not colored? Well, it's going to depend on the colors of the points just outside the boundary. So when we compare to the finite case, we sort of have to take those points with us. So in the finite case, we just have a finite tree, and we fix the colors on the edge just this way. And now we have a well-defined probability distribution here, given by that product formula. And we require that this thing behave exactly the same way. All probabilities for colorings in here are the same as probabilities for colorings in there. Now, in particular, for example, if we just look at one point, okay, suppose we just pick one point and suppose that we discover that its neighbors are all red. Okay, then that point could be either yellow or green. And if the activities are the same for yellow and green, so we're doing uniform distribution, then it should be 50-50 whether it's yellow or green. So that's going to be required of the infinite distribution because that's the way the finite distribution is going to behave. We also have two other requirements. Trees are very poorly connected. If you take a point out, the thing falls apart. Okay. So if we take some point and we color it already, then the tree falls apart into 3 pieces, and it should be the case that what happens on those 3 pieces is now independent. So we require that. And lastly, we don't want our probability distribution to treat any point of the tree differently from any other point. So we're going to require that the probability distribution be invariant under all the very many automorphisms of the complete binary tree. Again, all these things will be trivially true if the tree is finite, and this is everything we could think of to require of a nice uniform distribution when the tree is infinite. And now you might ask, have we required too much? Maybe there is no probability distribution on the colorings of the infinite tree that has all these nice properties. But the good news is, there is. And there is for any Cayley tree, and much more generally than that, and for any constraint graph. So you can always find them. The trouble is, sometimes there's more than one.
I don't think you've indicated that for a given constraint tree, what happens when you reach a dead end? You can't.
Well, what we're trying to do here it is. You're thinking along combinatorial lines, which we will go to in a moment, which is you're thinking of coloring the tree randomly by some process. Okay. What I'm doing now is I'm jumping over that chasm and just saying, let's not worry about how we're coloring this tree. Let's imagine that we've got some way to do it, and that gives us a probability distribution on colorings. Now we want to know what the properties of this probability distribution are.
But at one point you said you have this uncolored vertex, but the neighboring vertices tell you you have to choose between green and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now what happens when you have nothing to choose between?
Ah, well, that means that you haven't got a legal coloring. That has probability zero.
Probability zero.
Right.
I see.
You'll get to see it. You'll get to see an actual process for coloring a Cayley tree in a moment. So right now I'm speaking very abstractly about these probability distributions. But naturally, to do something with these things, we really want to get our hands on how to randomly color a tree, and that we will do. That requires a change of gears, though. A funny-looking slide. I want to talk a little bit about random walks on a graph. Now, some of you have run into random walks on graphs, a very nice topic. And your basic random walk on a graph, which is called a simple random walk, which is indicated by a dot because it's just one special case, is done by putting a token down on a vertex of a graph, and then each tick of the clock, you move the token to a uniformly randomly chosen neighbor. So the token stumbles around the graph. That's a random walk. Okay? And those can be generalized in many ways by weighting the edges, for example, or by making different probabilities in different directions. But what we want to do here is we want to generalize it just one level out to the red level on this picture by attaching real weights to the nodes of the graph. Okay, I've got some fixed graph, which is going to be our constraint graph, our little graph. And now I want to attach some real numbers to the nodes, and I want to make my random walk so that when I take a step, the probabilities are proportional to the weights of the nodes that I'm going to. So if I have a neighbor of weight 3 and a neighbor of weight 2, I choose the neighbor of weight 3 with probability 3/5, neighbor of weight 2 with probability 2/5. Okay. And that we call a node-weighted random walk. Okay. Now, we discovered two interesting things about node-weighted random walks. One of them has to do with the stationary distribution. And I'm going to leave that aside for now. The other one is the one we really need. And that is that node-weighted branching random walks on the constraint graph are the same essentially they give you these beautiful probability measures on random colorings of the tree. Okay, so this theorem at the bottom, let me raise it up, is going to tell us how to color a tree with any given constraint graph. Okay, now I'll show you how to do it. Okay, but wait a minute. There's this red word here that I didn't tell you about before. What is a branching random walk? Well, an ordinary random walk is done by a token. A branching random walk is done by an amoeba. Okay? And every time the amoeba takes a step, it divides. And if we're trying to color a K-ary tree, it has K babies, divides into K pieces. And every one of those pieces takes a random independent step. Okay? And they don't care if they run into each other. You know, after a very short while, there are amoebas swimming all over this little graph. But they're transparent. They just go their own way. They keep having babies. And while they're doing this, although they may not know it, they are coloring a Cayley tree. Here's how it's done. So here, I've just zeroed in on a piece of the constraint graph where I've isolated one amoeba who happens to be sitting on the green color. And it's time for that amoeba to take a step. And since it's coloring a binary tree, it divides into two baby amoebas. And it happens that one of them goes to the blue neighbor and one of them goes to the orange neighbor. The numbers here are the weights of these nodes, so presumably these guys were chosen with probabilities proportional accordingly. Okay. So while that's happening, what's happening on the tree is this first parent amoeba on the green node corresponds to a certain node of the Cayley tree having got colored green. And when the two babies of this amoeba move off to blue and orange, it means that the two children of this node got colored blue and orange, respectively. So as these amoebas are moving around and dividing, we're just coloring the tree from the root on out. Now, I haven't told you how the root got colored. Right? That's a little bit of a fudge. To color the root, you take the ancestral amoeba and throw it up in the air, and it lands with a splat on the constraint graph. Okay, and because of the extra force, it has three babies on that first landing instead of two. This seems artificial, but actually it does work, and it turns out that it doesn't matter which node of the tree that you selected to be that root node to color first, that this process actually gives you the same probability distribution for coloring the tree. Okay? Yes, Luis?
Does that first amoeba land uniformly on the node H or weighted accordingly?
Weighted according to the stationary distribution for a random walk. Okay? So the limiting distribution. So notice that because the amoebas move along the edges of the constraint graph, that we will never be doing an illegal coloring on the tree. Right? We can always be any edge of the tree is a parent to child edge. And because the child was colored by an amoeba moving along an edge of the constraint graph, the colors of the parent and child will then obey the constraint of the constraint graph. Okay. So it's easy to see that this process will give us a random coloring which obeys the hard constraints that we required. Now, it's not as easy to see, but it's actually not difficult. I can leave this as an exercise. To see that it also satisfies all these wonderful probability conditions we talked about. So this method of coloring the tree will give us a beautiful Gibbs distribution, which is invariant under all the automorphisms of the tree, and which has this simplicity property, this independence property. It's really nice. And it's not that much harder to see that every nice probability distribution on colorings of the tree can be obtained from one of these node-weighted branching random walks. So this beautiful correspondence is what enables us to understand these probability distributions. Without this, we're playing statistical physics without the pieces. But now we're playing combinatorics. This is a game we'd like to think we know. Yes, Jack.
It seems like you can model this amoeba splitting as another tree, and the walk is a homomorphism of this amoeba tree onto the given tree.
That's exactly what's happening. That's just another way to think of exactly what's happening. The splitting amoebas, the splitting amoebas, in effect, are a tree, mm-hmm. right there. They're the generation tree of the amoebas. And the places where these amoebas happen to land is the colors that go on this tree. That's just another way to think of the same thing. Now,
this won't work if you have cycles. If you wouldn't have the tree.
Yes? Yeah, unfortunately, this only works on the tree. Yeah, it's possible that you could make it work on a non-uniform tree, where the amoebas have different numbers of babies when they get to different nodes. Okay. And, we thought this was hard enough. Now, there's a bit of a catch to this, okay? Now, when we talked about these node-weighted branching random walks, we were talking about weights, positive real weights on the nodes of the constraint graph. But earlier, when we were talking about the probability distribution, we were talking about these activities, lambda, on the nodes of the constraint graph. And these two vectors of real numbers assigned to the nodes of the constraint graph are not the same. Okay? If you do the random walks, you get a probability distribution, but that probability distribution is not the one that corresponds to the node weights as activities. It corresponds to a different set of activities. Well, that's troublesome, but it's also the reason that things get interesting. So here's a sort of schematic picture of what's going on. Okay. We start with node weights on the vertices of the constraint graph, positive real numbers, and we get a stationary distribution. That's what I was mentioning in connection with Luis's question. But we get, depending on what branching tree we use, we get one of these nice probability distributions for colorings of the tree corresponding to some activity set lambda. Now, the map which goes from the node weights to the activity sets is actually a very straightforward, simple map. It's not linear. It's a straightforward, simple map which we could describe. Okay? And if we're doing it on a one-branching tree, otherwise known as an infinite path, then this map is one-to-one. So for every set of lambdas, there's one node-weighted random walk and vice versa. But if we do it on a multiply branching tree, a binary tree or more, then sometimes there's two different sets of node weights that lead to the same set of activities. And that's what we're really interested in. That means that there's two different candidates for the infinite distribution. And we have phase transition. Okay, so, but it depends on what the constraint graph is. For some constraint graphs, this never happens, no phase transition. And for other constraint graphs, we get it. So the object was to figure out which is which. But let me show you first an example of a constraint graph where we do get this phenomenon, and I'll show you what happens to it. Okay. This is my favorite one of our constraint graphs, which we call the hinge. Okay, and actually corresponds to a physical model called the Wittem-Rolandson model. And you can see that the only constraint imposed by this graph is that you're not allowed to color adjacent vertices green and red. Anything else is allowed. You're just not allowed to have green and red together. It's a model of two different gases competing for space. Now, suppose we assign node weights proportional to 4, 2, 1. And we take a node-weighted random walk, and we use it to color a binary tree. Okay. Well, now, these node weights are heavily biased toward green and against red. So you would think that when you compute the conditional probabilities for the coloring of the tree, that they would greatly favor green over red. But if you actually compute the probabilities, say that you know that a point has three yellow neighbors, so it could be either green or red, or yellow for that matter. But somehow, because the random walk branches, when you make the computations, you discover that that point is equally likely to have been either red or green. The intuition is that you were more likely to go to green from yellow. But if you went to red to yellow, then you were more likely to go back to yellow for the two children. And these things all cancel out, and you end up with equal activity for red and green. And that means that if we switch the labelings, we would get the same activities. And that's indeed what happens. Let me show you what the result actually looks like. There's also a set of activities which is a set of node weights which is symmetrical, which gives these activities. So there are actually three different random walks which give us colorings of the tree with the same specifications. Okay? We call these the September, October, and November phases. The phase that you get by the 4-2-1 weighting, green, yellow, red, actually looks like this. This maple leaf was authentic. It was traced from a leaf from my backyard. It's not from the Canadian flag, this is the symmetric October phase. And finally, this is the November phase. And now, let me repeat. What does it mean that these are all phases of the same specification? It means that by looking locally at these trees, at conditional probabilities, you cannot tell the difference between these colorings. Right? Now, globally, yeah, one of them is mostly red, one of them is mostly green, and one of them is mixed up pretty evenly. But locally, if you pick out pieces and compute conditional probabilities, these trees are indistinguishable. These colorings are indistinguishable from one another. We get three phases. What's the bottom line? Oh, yeah. I just want to show you that the green phase appeared on a course catalog. Written, again, in this other form. So we know that the hinge is a constraint graph which can produce this phase transition. And it turns out that there are six others. So here's what we call the seven fertile graphs. We gave them all one-syllable names because we knew we'd have to work with them a lot in the proof. And this would save time. Interesting collection of graphs. So what is the theorem? The theorem is that if your constraint graph contains one of these guys as an induced subgraph, then you get your phase transition. And if it doesn't, you don't. Here's what the theorem looks like. Okay. Don't read this. Let me just tell you what they say. The first theorem says that there's always one of these nice measures, no matter what the graph is, no matter how many branches a tree has, and what the activities are. You can always get one. And second one says that there's always a disordered phase. You could always choose the lambda so that there's only one nice measure. And the third one tells you which graphs give you multiple measures and which ones don't. And here what I've done is I've written down the graph theoretic description of a sterile graph. Turned out to be one in which every loop node is adjacent to all other nodes, and if you take the loops away, then the graph is complete multipartite. And you have to think a while about what all this means. And it's a fun graph theoretic exercise to finish off the graph theory part of this theorem, to see that a graph fits this description if and only if it does not contain one of those seven small fertile graphs on the other page. Okay. Now, let me just wind up by saying that there's more to this that I'm leaving out. There's a nice application to an old problem from statistical physics about whether one of these models could have multiple critical points. And there is also an application to the special case of ordinary coloring, which you can ask me and Graham about if you want to. And lastly, I promised a lead-in. We discovered in the process of doing this that there were really two natural graph divisions that come up in this subject. And one of them is, as you see here, is between sterile graphs and fertile graphs, graphs that induce phase transitions and graphs that don't. But there's another very nice one that came up, and we didn't even know what we were talking about in the beginning of this, but Graham will explain that, between dismantleable graphs and non-dismantleable graphs, and that will be the subject of this afternoon's talk. So thank you very much, and available for questions.